sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
China devalues the yuan, Shake Shack imploding, oil hitting new lows, and our guest today, Ellen Luyen, who is a great author of the book Branded for Life. All this and much more on episode number 425 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, hello there. Andrew Horowitz here, and you're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. It's, where are we now? We're in the mid part of August, soft season for investing as many investors, traders, and folks on the desk take vacations, go out to the Hamptons, go out on vacation around the world, wherever it is. A lot of times they're not trading. Although there has been reports that in the last couple of years, things have changed a bit and more traders are actually staying put, not going out and not taking their vacation because it's, I guess, more important to generate more revenue for the trading desk as volume has tailed off. And volume is been a bit hot lately. We've seen that over the last couple of weeks, clearly in the down days, the volume has been high. And that's a function of a lot of different things. One of the things being that you have not just a one directional trade, oftentimes where you see markets just moving up and volume is light. Why is that? Well, a couple of different reasons. But one of the reasons also is that you have buyers in there, not many sellers as in comparison. You know, you don't have kind of a up and down market. The volatility where you see things moving up and down in a big way brings on a lot of volume because what you have is people on both sides really being very actively involved, either dumping or buying shares. So when you don't have a lot of that, it kind of tends to be a market that is more complacent. These days, we're seeing that we're still in the range for the S&P 500. We're seeing that the play out of some of the themes that we have been watching where commodities are moving lower, generally speaking, large caps, particularly in the Dow Jones and the mega caps, multinationals are being hurt by the strong dollar. And that wasn't helped at all by the recent devaluation of the yuan in China. Now, that came as a surprise this week. We saw that the Chinese government set a different reference rate for the currency and allowed it to float within a much wider range, and they actually did a devaluation as we know it by about 1.9% overnight it was overnight on Monday for us. It was Tuesday morning for them. And that kind of really caused a bit of a problem for markets. And that was just getting things a little bit, actually Tuesday. It was Tuesday for them. So that, why did they do that? Well, you know, what's the reason for this and what's the long-term effect of this? Well, we know that their economy has been slowing. We saw that export growth was really just anemic. We saw that manufacturing has slowed. Their services sector is okay. We're also seeing that the question about whether or not they have the sustainability of GDP in the neighborhood of 7%, how that's going to play out. A lot of concern about that when you look at all the other numbers. Now, what do they do? Well, they see that the rest of the world, inclusive of the United States and Europe and other places, have been dropping their rates, and that has effectively caused their currencies over time, not recent for the U.S. dollar, but currencies over time to drop, and that has made their exports much more competitive. And as China, even though they want to say that they're a domestically driven economy, that's something they're moving towards, they're not there yet, not by any stretch of the imagination. So what happens is they drop their currency down, making it so that their exports are that much more affordable for others. Where's the problem? Well, we saw what happened with Apple. Apple dropped 5% on the news because the fact is that their products become much more expensive. The other side is that imports become much more expensive. Again, trying to drive two things, trying to drive exports, but also trying to drive domestic spending directly in China, because if in fact it is much more expensive for the Chinese to buy any kind of products from outside of China, well, it's going to force them to stay within China and stay within their borders in terms of products they'll be buying. And that would hopefully help their economy. Now, they did this for 2 days in a row, and at first the Chinese markets really didn't get affected very much. Then they dropped the next day. It really kind of was a biggest concern for Europe, because Europe is the biggest trading partner and has the greatest, at least from a proximity standpoint, outside of Asia, has the greatest amount of potential exports that they're going to provide for China. Car manufacturers got hit. You saw that many of the higher end retail got hit. And this is going to be a continuing problem if China is just beginning. Now, they said, this is a one-off. A one-time thing. We're going to do this only once. Don't worry about it. But you know what? The second day, they let it float in a wide range again, pushing it up. We have almost a 4.5% move lower for the yuan against the U.S. dollar. Now, meanwhile, you would think, well, the U.S. dollar would come up with that, right? You think that commodities get smashed because, you know, the U.S. dollar would be moving higher. But what actually happened was fascinating. One of the things that we do note is that the yen and the euro are heavily shorted, and especially against the yuan, because it's a stable currency. And the fact is that you'd have this opportunity to have a carry trade on the currencies that were outside of China. So you would short the euro, for example, against the yuan. You would short the yen against the yuan. And what happened is that everybody had a cover. Massive covering going on here, because all of a sudden there was a devaluation of their currency. They're buying euros, and how do they get euros? Well, they're buying it against yuan, but also they're buying it against the U.S. dollar. Any way they can get their hands on this to cover their trade. And what we saw was that commodities, in particular gold, shot up. Oil, forget about it. Just disastrous. You know, it was a whole Iran deal that hopefully will be revoked. And all of the drilling that's going on in the shale regions of the United States, which, by the way, this week now they're coming out with a number that they can make profits on oil and their drilling process down to about $30 a barrel. This is unusual, because just last year it was $70. $70 was the break-even point for the very expensive fracking / shale exploration. And now all of a sudden it's $30. But okay. So now we have this situation in China that probably is not going to end here. If they continue to have a widening rate, reference rate on their currency, the potential is that there's going to be a lot more volatility, and that may in fact be very detrimental, even a 2 to 4% move. The theory is they may go anywhere from 5 to 10% on a drop on their currency, and that will have massive effects, because they are such a large economy and how they do consume so much on major companies. And you could think of the names that probably would be affected the worst. Now, in the United States, we're still seeing that the economy is doing well. We saw last week that the jobless number, the initial claims number, was actually, I think the four-week moving average was the lowest on record. And that's pretty good in terms of employment, and still a head-scratcher as how employment is staying so high, as we are seeing such a fallback in some areas of retail and in manufacturing. But clearly the bright spot, by no question about this, is the service industries. A lot of restaurants, eating out, various services that are being utilized. Matter of fact, this year I think the recent research shows that more money will be spent eating out than actually eating at home on groceries than ever before in history. And that goes to the idea that fast food and alternative measures of eating, quickly grabbing something, is become much more affordable and much easier. You don't have to go out for an entire dinner. I find it sad, because I thought mealtime was supposed to be a time to just take a quick break, maybe spend time with friends and family, maybe do some business. But it was a time when it was semi-sacred, and you would spend time and reflect, maybe a bit meditational in a way. And now it's just kind of grab and go. For the most part, quickly get it done, eat and move on. But we'll see what happens with that. Now, with that in mind, we saw that Shake Shack, one of these stocks that I've been focused on, is, wow, this is just terribly overvalued. How can it stay where it's staying? They came out with their earnings. They beat same store sales. They beat earnings. They beat revenues. We talked about this a little bit about how this is all playing out. One of the things is that their same store sales are a very small selection of New York based restaurants, from what I can see. And that is a little bit misleading in terms of the same store sales growth. Only expected to open about 8 stores over the next year. But one of the things that I found really interesting was that they snuck it in. They just kind of like just snuck it right in there with the earnings, that there's going to be a 4 million share offering from the company. And the stock reversed around from a high of about 12% gain in the after hours to the next day where it started to lose money. Now, the offering came out a couple of days later at $60 a share. Now, the stock was trading somewhere north of, I guess it was about 65. And they come out with an offering at $60. And I'm thinking, wow, that's kind of interesting. They've chewed up all the IPO money already, it seems, or they need more money. They're trying to release these shares. Still very difficult. Can't get a short borrow on this. Maybe you can at your firm, but we have your company that you work with, whether it's a brokerage firm out there that has the shares. Tells me that obviously the shares are very much well shorted at this point, but with the 4 million share offering, I thought there would have been an opening. There was a small window that I saw there, but just really no shares available. And the company decided that they would postpone the offering of their options for some later date in the future. I don't know what happened there. They were supposed to be available, I believe, in August, the beginning of August, and kaplooey, all of a sudden, they're not available. Nothing available on that. So couldn't capitalize too much on that, but I still think that Shake Shack is a well overvalued name. It reminds me of Pollo Loco. And if you looked at what happened with those shares after the initial excitement over the stock, not looking so good. All right, what else do we got to talk about? Oil. Oil hitting kind of a low towards the 42.5, 43 level. The continuation of some of these trends that are showing a significant surplus and glut of oil plays out. That's probably not a good thing. It's something we talked about as the canary in the coal mine for some time. While it does benefit the consumer, potentially, if we could see the flow through to gas prices, which we haven't seen as we saw when it first dropped many, many months ago. But we are seeing that there is at least the potential for a benefit for consumers. We'll see how that plays out. All right, what other news? Lots of other things happening around the world. But you know what? I wanted to, I'm going to take some time to spend a little time with our guest. Now, what I thought we'd do is, you know, we try to bring on a mix of different guests. Last week, we had Jim Rogers talking about world economic, and we talked about ideas of where he should be investing. There's some questions I probably should have asked him on how in the heck he actually can invest in Iran, North Korea. But nonetheless, I didn't. I'll get him the second time around. We have coming up a market commentator next week. Declan Falcon. We have Cullen Roche coming up, and that's pretty exciting. Then we have Tadas Viscontis. That's in September. But we have a full slate of guests coming up over the next few weeks that are very much involved in markets. This week, though, I thought we would change it up just to kind of get a different side of the business aspect, the whole idea of, you know, branding and what's involved in that. And it may not be, you know, tremendously in line with our investing thesis, but I think it's important to understand how the business world thinks, plays, and maybe even some benefits for you and I on how we can actually make ourselves and help our own personal branding or our own business branding. So I thought we would bring on something a little bit different and see how that plays out. We'll see how it goes. As mentioned earlier, our guest today, Ellen Luyen, who is an author of a great book called Branded for Life. And she's a leader in personal branding. We're going to kind of talk about that, change it up a little bit today, because I think that, you know, the whole aspect of business, not only investments, is important to understand. So, Ellen, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, Andrew?
I'm great. Thanks so much. I'm pretty intrigued with this whole concept of personal branding, you know, and kind of this whole idea that you get away from just a, you know, when people think of the word, I think brand, it's, oh, you know, craft or something like that. But explain to me, what is a personal brand?
Well, first of all, the thing most people don't realize is that they're already a personal brand, whether they're managing it or not. So that's really important, because if you're not managing your brand, the rest of us are branding you however we want to. So it's much better to be proactive and decide how you want people to perceive you, and then you can manage your perception of value, and that's what branding really is all about. And it's about connecting your message of value, excuse me, emotionally to the people you most want to influence. So when people hear your name, certain perceptions come to mind, and that's really your personal brand. So why not, you know, take advantage of proactively managing it? I love what Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, says about branding. He said, your brand is what people say about you when you're not in the room.
Mm.
So that's basically what branding is. It's about how others perceive and experience your value and the impressions you leave behind.
And I guess that a lot of that has to do with a consistent message, like consistency of the message, right?
Absolutely. That's a hallmark of good branding, any kind of branding, whether you're branding a car, a toothpaste, or yourself. That consistency is most important, and particularly in personal branding. I always quote a teacher of mine years ago said that the way you do one thing is the way you do everything. And that is pretty much how your brand is perceived. So if you're chronically late for meetings, that's part of your brand and something you might want to look at and change. So, yeah, it takes in everything, the way people perceive us, the way they feel around us. Brands are felt, and that's why they're so powerful, because they're first registered emotionally, and only later are they logically interpreted.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah. I was thinking about some experiences I've had in the past where, for example, excuse me, there was there's a guy I know. He was a golfer, and I played golf with him, and he was just a great golfer. And I remember myself, and this is a little bit offbeat, but saying, you know, he's a really good golfer. I want to do business with him, you know, because he's a good golfer. I'm thinking that that extends to something else. And whereas maybe I was on the golf course and somebody is sloppy and not playing well, who could be a fantastic whatever it is that they do, I may say, well, I don't really want to work with them. My point is, I'm not expecting everybody to be a great golfer, okay, and or great in sports or something like that. But I could see how the idea of, you know, of putting yourself out there in a particular, you know, brand or a particular way can transcend into other parts of your life.
Well, excuse me, and that's why my book is called Branded for Life, 8 Elements to Transform Your Personal Brand, Career, and Life. Because it's not just about your career. It's really about how you live your life. You know, you can't be, well, you can be, I suppose, but you know, if you're a great philanthropist and you're into helping people and you go home and kick the dog and beat your wife, that's kind of inconsistent, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
So your brand doesn't have integrity, and that's felt by people. In fact, you know, that congruence where your words and your physiology are all in alignment is a big part of how brands are felt, because sometimes we just don't trust or believe someone, and we don't really register why that's so, but it's more of a feeling. And that's usually what's happening, because we communicate on so many levels, non-verbally especially. So people don't realize that within the first seven seconds of meeting somebody, you're already projecting your personal brand, good, bad, or indifferent.
That first 7 seconds, or that viewing that I mentioned earlier about, oh, somebody plays golf well, so therefore they may do, you know, be good in business or something of that nature, may or may not be correct. In other words, you know, we're predisposed to our ideas, obviously, because they are ours, and we may be turned on or turned off from something. Now, I want to transpose this for a second into like the stock market. You know, you may like a brand or you may not like a brand, and you may be predisposed to say, well, I don't like the taste of that hot dog, therefore I'm not going to buy the stock in that company. And sometimes you need to, I think, on the other side of the brand, on the other side of the receiving side, open yourself up a little bit to the fact that, hey, you know what? Yours may not be the only way to look at this. So
yeah, but it doesn't happen that way. That's great. In an ideal world, that's a wonderful theory, Andrew, but that's not how people are.
No.
So I've been doing this for almost 30 years, and I can tell you that we have perceptions of things, whether they're rational or not. They are our perceptions, and we're entitled to them. For example, here, I have a great example for you. Well, I'm a keynote speaker, so I often speak to hundreds of people in a room at a conference, mm-hmm. and I play a little game with them to illustrate the power of branding. So I ask them to think of a European car that is their brand name is so entwined with the attribute of safety that when we think of safety in a car, and then I have the whole room on the count of three tell me the car I'm thinking of, and 500 people bark back the Volvo brand.
Volvo, yeah, I was thinking that.
So, you know, is Volvo safer than a BMW or a Mercedes? Probably not. But Volvo got to that word safety first and locked in their brand with that attribute. And whether it's true or not, and a lot of brand perceptions are not true. You know, it used to be like if your teeth were whiter than white, you would be sexy and have a great social life. That's what the toothpaste commercials were trying to convince us to sell their brand. So it's just like that. It's like people manipulate our sensibilities. I'm not suggesting that, by the way. The way I do branding is quite the opposite. It's all about someone's authentic representation. But you know, branding is about manipulating the human experience to like a mm-hmm. certain product or person in a very certain way. So, you know, Volvo is a great example. You know, they're probably, you know, they're known as a family and a safe car. But maybe, you know, if they were tested, they're no safer than a bunch of other cars on the right. road. But everyone has that perception,
yep.
and perception is reality.
Yeah, perception
branding.
Equals reality. Now, you have eight elements
yes.
that you have identified in your book. It's actually
yes.
the subtext of your book. And these things will transform, as you say, your personal brand, your career, and your life. So can you kind of go through some of those or all of those?
Yeah, well, let me set up the context for those eight elements.
Uh-huh.
I made a study of charismatic influence for decades and what charisma is and how can people get it and can the couch potato learn to be charismatic and why does the charismatic candidate win the election or win your business. So anyway, when I deconstructed charisma, which is known as the third form of influence after, let me give you this exactly, I don't like quoting things that I don't have exactly right. It's the third form of authority
mm-hmm.
after law and tradition, and that was said by Max Weber back in the 1930s. He was the first one to take charisma out of the religious realm and put it into the sociological realm. Anyway, all my life I've been told I'm very charismatic. I was one of the first women in sales at IBM back in the day, and I always got the job and always got what I was after, the sale, and a lot of it was because of my ability to influence. Well, it turns out that charisma is really a rare combination of strength and warmth, and that's what makes people so influential that have charisma. So I've been teaching and saying this for over 20 years, and then a book came out a few years ago that was the Harvard research around all of this. And it turns out that they said the hidden qualities of influence, it's from a book called Compelling People. It's a great book, by the way. I don't like recommending other people's books now that I have my own best-selling book, but but they do substantiate what I've been saying for years, and it's very well written. Anyway, in the book Compelling People, they say that the hidden qualities of influence are, in fact, strength and warmth. And I can look at a person in 7 seconds and size them up, whether they have that equal, irresistible ratio of strength and warmth, i.e. charismatic influence. So when I started doing corporate work several years ago, I used to brand people like, you know, professional services, people like myself, coaches, consultants, CPAs, lawyers, realtors, etc. And then about 3.5 years ago, I was discovered by Corporate America and started doing my work globally in 60 countries, as a matter of fact, for Corporate America. And my clients became, you know, clients like Cisco and HP and Oracle and a lot of big tech companies here in the Silicon Valley where I'm located in the Bay Area. Anyway, long story short, big corporations didn't like me talking about charisma. They thought it was fluffy, and why does their engineer need to be charismatic? But it turns out leaders do need to be charismatic. And, you know, the way I teach leadership training is through these eight elements. So I kept the eight elements, which spell out the word charisma. I got a little far afield from the whole dissecting and distilling the essence of what charisma is. But we do all know that charisma is that intangible it factor that makes someone win an election or win a client. So it's really important. And my eight elements, which spell out the word charisma, are consciously manage your state of mind, have self-awareness, artfully communicate, radiate empathy and likability, inspire confidence, serve as a leader, maintain presence, and authentically project your true self. And within each of those eight elements, I teach all kinds of people how to achieve that. And the most important one is element number seven about presence, because we actually are most influential when we live in the present moment and we communicate in the present moment. And that's really difficult for people to do these days in this 21st, you know.
Oh, yeah, so much stuff flying at you from all the different directions. And, you know, exactly. you're maybe present to something, but it may not last too long. It's kind of like we're forced to be ADD in a world where, you know, we're kind of drinking from an open fire hydrant.
Exactly, exactly. And I work, you know, in especially here in the San Francisco Bay Area, where, you know, all the tech companies and all the brilliance emanates from. I mean, it's dangerous to drive around here. Everybody's texting every minute of the day and walking into each other. You know, I went to a conference in early June with Eckhart Tolle, who's the author of The Power of Now, a wonderful book on how to develop presence. In fact, I recommend that people get the audio version because there's something about his voice and the transmission of his teachings. Anyway, I spent 5 days with him at a retreat down here in Northern California on the coast, and it was amazing. There were 500 people from all over the world. In fact, very few Americans, which I think is very telling. Mm. Americans are not particularly a present people. Anyway, it was so refreshing for 5 days to be with my tribe of people who are fully present. Nobody was checking their, you know, devices or walking into you as they're texting, and everybody gave you their full attention. It was just amazing. I'd never experienced anything like that. So there is a lot to be said about presence, and I teach a lot about presence.
But let me just interrupt you for a second. The whole, I get it, and I totally agree with you about being present, particularly when you're dealing with someone one-on-one or maybe a small group or whatever, but, you know, during the average day, you know, it seemed to me that the way that our productivity has changed over the last number of years is that, you know, I'll give an example. Kids, when they're studying, they're watching TV, they're listening to their music, and they're studying at the same time, texting all at the same time. Now, I'm of the belief that how the hell can anybody study with, you know, for school or something like that with all that going on? But they swear that they could do it, and then they pull off the grades and whatever. Now,
well, you know what? I will tell you right here, before you even go any further, that it's been scientifically proven that our IQ actually lowers when we multitask. So that's not true. They're not studying better.
No, I know that.
You know, they're
know
checking off studying off their to-do list because they were there and they kind of felt and looked like they were studying. But they're not going to retain that information. And, you know, they may retain enough to take a test tomorrow. But that's not the case. Their IQ actually lowers, all of ours, when we multitask. So
no,
I don't know
what I'm saying was,
you were trying to make.
No, I get what you're saying. All I was saying is I get the whole idea of being present and how important it is, and particularly with relationships. But the average day that goes by where you have to do multiple things, and whether you have that checklist, not saying do it all at once, but you may be present very – when I think of the word present, I think of a kind of a longer experience in dealing with something. But, you know, maybe you're present to something for very short quips. You
presence
know,
little... happens in the moment.
Yep.
It's moment by moment.
Yeah.
It's not about a longer experience. It's, you know, I'm talking to you right now. I could be checking my emails while you're talking to me. I've done enough of these interviews. I pretty much know what people are going to ask me. But I'm fully present. And I'm sure that people will notice that the quality of their experience with me feels somewhat different than it might with someone who wasn't fully present.
Yeah.
So, you know, I give a lot of webinars and global webinars. And I know that when I, you know, I'm not perfect either. When I take a webinar and they lose my interest for a few minutes, I might be paying my bills or checking emails or cleaning out a desk drawer or doing something that, you know, where I'm not fully present. But it's really different. I always challenge people to go through a day and be fully present. And most of us notice ourselves, including me, like when I'm driving, I'll notice, oh, I wasn't even paying attention these last 5 minutes.
Yeah, where was
I? Who was driving my car? You know, as I was deep in thought about my proposal to Cisco, you know, right. And how am I going to get that piece of work? So, you know, it's like that. And how often when someone's talking to you, you're nodding your head in agreement, you're making eye contact, but you're thinking about your shopping list on your way home,
right.
Or picking up your kid from a soccer game, or, you know, whatever it is.
So let me yeah. There's something I want to ask you about. So you know, we talk about teaching, you know, people how to be charismatic, or, you know, obtain their charisma, and or maybe even some coaching and things of that nature. And a lot of it is to, I assume from a holistic sense, to bring out what's within, so that you can optimize and you can be the best you can be. Let's just kind of say, let's use that just for a moment.
Yeah, that's very accurate.
That's the good out of it, right? You know, that's a good thing. On the other hand, you know, one of the things that I'm gonna shift over to the world of investing here for a second. You know, I listen to these conference calls. Now, one of the things I do know about these conference calls is that a lot of times the board is sitting there, they're having this discussion, not in every circumstance, but they have this discussion about what's going on with their earnings, their outlook, and things of that nature. And at the same time, they have people watching, like, what's happening with the stock price in the background, to make sure that any words that are being said and any kind of inferences that are being made and any kind of outlook that's being projected is not going to hit the stock. And if it does, by the way, what they'll do is they'll kind of, like, you know, adjust what they're saying. It's kind of like ratings, instant ratings. They'll adjust what they're saying, possibly, if they're not just reading it, or they'll adjust their answers or clarify something. Or if something hits really well and there is a lot of, you know, it's kind of like watching the debates where you see on the bottom of the screen the people that are pushing the button.
Mm-hmm.
Same concept. To what end do we see that as creating manipulation of people to believe something that may not be 100% accurate, or at least make it, let's put it this way, glossing over something, making it look better? I mean, where's that differential?
Well, you know, the way I do branding is all about authenticity and integrity. So I don't believe in using strategy like that to get someone to do something they don't want to do, or to have an outcome that's artificial. Or so I don't even know how to answer that question, honestly. It's so not the way I do branding.
I guess we're in agreement then. We're in agreement that
yeah,
is...
Yeah, I can't make a silk purse out of a sow's ear. If you're a jerk, I'm not going to take you as a client, number one. And number two, I could make you look really good, because I'm very talented at making people look really good and successful and having the right sound bites. But I'm not the right person to help somebody
manipulate
a result.
The bigger picture was, you know, that... On one hand, you know, there is this whole idea of helping people to optimize and to create this, you know, charismatic image of themselves for the good. And the other side is, you know, how do we find, if you, in 7 seconds, you can size somebody up. It's good if we could find 7 seconds to size up the other side, which is a false pretense. I guess that would be the other side of this, right?
A big part of the way I do branding, it has a very strong emotional intelligence component to it. So having self-awareness is actually element number two. So it's really about understanding who we really are and how to position and package the best of ourselves, not to position and package the way we wish we were,
mm-hmm.
or the way we want to be. Now, brands can be aspirational. You know, you can position and package you at your very best, even though you're not like that 24/7.
Mm-hmm.
But again, silk purse, sow's ear, the twain shall never meet. You know, it's like that for me.
So,
as I look at some of these idiot political figures, you know, I could never package them. And, you know, I could probably help anybody win an election, because I understand how, you know, human perception works. And I could manipulate that if I was so inclined, but I'm so not inclined to do
don't
that.
Worry. Don't
so,
worry. There's a plenty of people that do that on a regular basis.
Yeah, exactly,
they probably don't need
exactly.
your resume at this point.
No, I don't think so.
So how could, give me kind of, for those people out there that are, you know, thinking, hey, you know what? I'd like to be more, whether it's personally or from a business standpoint, right, from their business part of their life and their projection, and maybe somebody who's starting a business and wants to put the right foot forward. What's kind of like, just very quickly, a couple of things and little tips you can give them to do the right thing?
Well, first of all, you know, interestingly enough, my book reads more like a novel than a how-to business book. and it follows two characters. The male character is of Indian descent, and he's an engineer in the Silicon Valley and very introverted with very little people skills.
Mm-hmm.
But he's very good at what he does, so he's got a lot of strength but virtually no warmth and self-awareness, neither one. His wife is an American-born certified financial planner who is so personable and so extroverted and so warm that she's losing business because her clients, who have high net worth, are not taking her seriously. She's more like someone they might want to invite to a barbecue because she's interesting and fun to hang out with, but her strengths are not coming through to the detriment of all the warmth she's emanating. So my book follows these two characters. They're a husband and wife team, Sanjay and Susan, one introverted, one extroverted, one strong, one warm, as they go through and build their brand. So I have a lot of tools in the back of my book in the appendix. And the best way to start out, you asked me for some easy tips. So whether someone reads my book or not, they can do this. They can develop a questionnaire, although there's one in the back of my book with a cover letter. And they could send this out. They could send out a questionnaire because it's very important to understand how you're currently being perceived. And most of us are clueless about our current perceptions out in the world, no matter who we are or what we do. I find this rampant all over, and I've been doing this a long time. So the first thing to do is to take a survey, and I call it a personal impact survey, to see just how impactful your brand is out in the world and what people are saying about you. Then you look at, branding's about thinking backwards, so you think about, well, how do I want to be perceived? And sometimes people are appalled at what they find out in terms of the way they're currently being perceived by the people they most want to influence. So it's a good thing, I tell people, because you have the power to, value's only a perception, and we have the power to decide how we want our value to be perceived, and that's what branding's all about. So if you don't like the way you're currently being perceived, then change it up. For example, you know, I gave, last week I had a book signing at a local Neiman Marcus store here in the Bay Area of San Francisco. And Neiman Marcus, for those that don't know, is a very upscale retail store. Probably
hootie-tootie, kind of hootie-tootie.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So they have a private space there. And one of my financial planning clients, a young woman in her 30s, had me brand her 5 years ago, and within a year of her branding, she tripled her business.
Wow.
And she is so radically successful now that she could afford to throw me a book signing champagne reception with food like my wedding was back in the day. And I'm inviting my VIP clients from Chevron and Kaiser Permanente and IBM. So it was, I gave her the tagline. Was all about helping young women in their 20s and 30s create a financial plan now, not waiting till they're in their 50s or 60s when it's too late. So she's all about having fun, and she puts on these client appreciation, happy hour parties, which was in line with her brand, what she did for me. And I gave her 5 years ago the tagline, "Girls just gotta have funds," F-U-N-D-S. Changed her business, tripled it within a year, and she is probably one of the most successful financial planning women of her age in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Impressive.
With that look and feel and tagline of making financial planning fun. So that's an example of great branding. It's understanding who the person is. Now, I couldn't have a brand like that because I'm not in my 30s. And, you know, I don't think of financial planning as fun, frankly. And I do things differently than she, but it fits Sarah so well.
Yes, it fits her. In other words, the everything matches across the board. That's the point. You know,
it's all in alignment.
It's like you can't, you know, I keep coming back to investing, but, you know, it's like if you are a day trader, it may be tough for you to be a long-term buy and hold kind of person, and vice versa. Someone who's trading on a 10-minute interval where they want to be in and out and all that, the thought of holding something for 30 days is repulsive. And if you try to do that, it can be very detrimental to your portfolio.
And I would try to brand a person like that around their speed of perception of how quickly they can identify a good investment.
Right.
And that's the kind of person you'd want to work with if that's what you were interested in.
Right. Well, yeah, Ellen,
so
we're out of time.
What people have.
We're out of time. Ellen Luyen, who has the book available on Amazon, we'll put some links on the show notes. Branded for Life. You can find out about the eight elements. You can find out about the personal the questionnaire about, you know, what the perception is of people, how to be present, and how to do what you can to optimize and create a you which would be in business, or maybe even personally, that can be, I guess, remembered. So I want to thank you for joining us. Appreciate it. All right, we're going to take this to a close here today. And I did want to remind you, though, that if you are interested in any of the things that we do here at Horowitz & Company, of course, we have various strategies that are available for individual investors. $50,000 minimum is the number for the TDIMG, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. And for the Arrow algorithm, that is an algorithmic trading system that utilizes just a number of different technical indicators on the S&P 500 to look for oversold, overbought, and trending characteristics. And it is based on the S&P 500. And we utilize the ETFs for that, actually easy in and out of the long, short, or neutral positioning that we have for that. And you could find out more information about that on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And of course, if you want more information, we'll send you all sorts of things about each of the strategies, a quick video online for TDI, Managed Growth Strategy, and a quick PDF with some other things in it involved with the Arrow strategy. A-I-R-O is the way we spell that, by the way. But anyway, if you have any questions, send them to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com as well. Thanks for joining me. Take some time off this this week to spend some time in the last few days of the summer, the official summer, that is, and get some sun, enjoy the water, enjoy the outdoors, give yourself a little bit of treat. Thanks so much for joining me. I'll see you again next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.